About somebody who's relatively new in the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
if they want to put me in the West, and people say that, you know, it's nice to be Indian, you know, when they go home, they have very good lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought perhaps someone who could suggest some type of practice that these people could do who were interested in developing some practice that have very busy lives and don't have so much time.
Okay, so Dharma practice for the West. But we have very, very busy lives and we don't have much time and we want to become enlightened as we want enlightenment to be quick, cheap, and easy. Okay? Forget it. Okay? There's no push button enlightenment. It's not quick, cheap, and easy. Okay? We really have to put time in. So, the amount of time you put in depends upon the depth of your sincerity in your practice. The more Dharma means to you, the more you set Dharma as your priority, even in your Western life. Okay. People in the West, they always say, I have to blah, blah, blah. That's the big thing. I have to go to work. I have to do this for my kids. I have to go to this party. I have to go to this reception. I have to go buy these clothes. I have to go shopping. I have to pay my insurance. Everybody says have to. I think one of the big things is to realize we don't have to. Okay? The only thing we have to do in life, the only thing, is die. The only thing we have to do in life. Okay? Everything else is optional. Everything else is optional. The only thing we have to do is die. When we say, I have to X, Y, Z, therefore I don't have any time, that is a big excuse. We are making ourselves into victims when we say, I have to. Nobody's sitting there holding a gun to our head saying, I'm going to kill you if you don't go to work. Okay. We are choosing to go to work. We are choosing to go to that party. We are choosing to buy a house with a mortgage. We are choosing to get into a relationship. We are choosing to be influenced by what our parents and society think. We are choosing to work overtime. Okay? All that is our choice. There's always an alternative. You're going to say, but if I don't work overtime, I won't have so much money, so I have to work overtime. No, you do have a choice. Okay? You're choosing money and overtime over less money and more time. You are making a choice at that moment. It's not that you have to work overtime. It's because money is more of a priority than other things in your life. Okay? So I think the best thing to do is always to be very honest with ourselves. And as soon as you find yourself in your self-talk or saying to somebody else, I have to, change it into I choose to. And then look again, is this really what you want to choose? Okay? Because when we say I have to, we're giving up our power. When we say I have to, we're living on automatic. We're letting the past, the river of karma from the past, the river of afflictions from the past, just push us along whenever we say I have to. Okay? When we say I choose to, it means that we're stopping, we're not living on automatic, we're evaluating what really is of the greatest benefit at this moment. Now, sometimes we know what is of the greatest benefit, and we do the opposite. That happens, doesn't it? Yeah. The greatest benefit in this moment would be if I kept my mouth shut. But here I am, saying blah 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 blah. You know? Okay, we get overwhelmed by afflictions. It happens. Okay, I chose to tell that person off because my mind was totally under the power of afflictions at that moment. Okay, I didn't have to say that to them. I chose to because my mind was uncontrolled. So let's back up. What can I do next time so that my mind is not so uncontrolled? Yeah, let's back up. Now, how do I practice the Dharma in this situation? Yeah. So lots of times we do make unwise choices. We do it all the time. But it's a thing of at the end of the day being able to look back and own what our unwise choices are. Okay. As soon as we say, I have to, we're not really owning our own decisions. We're not taking responsibility for our own lives. So when people, you know, I notice in the West, you know, the big thing, oh, I can't come for teachings because I have to take care of my family. I can't go on retreat because I have to work overtime. I can't do this because I have to da-da-da-da-da. You know, and the big things in the West are big excuses, are sacrosanct excuses that nobody else is allowed to question is when we say, I don't have time and I don't have money. Okay, those are our two precious sacrosanct excuses. It is extremely rude for somebody to say, and why don't you have money to do this? It's very rude for somebody to say, wait a minute, you just bought some new clothes, and you went to a movie, and you went out to dinner, and you're saying you don't have money to pay for room and board to do retreat? It's extremely rude to say that. So when we say I don't have money, then nobody else can question that. Okay. But it's a big excuse, isn't it? Same thing with I don't have time. Yeah?
Okay, yeah,
sure.
I'm wondering about the relationship between Western nuns and lay people. And it would be so pertinent to the women here exactly today, but this is part of your reality and your day-to-day life in the West. And I'm thinking in particular about how Christian nuns have had to develop different forms of living because communities no longer can no longer provide the kind of support that they need to have. And so, for example, Catholic nuns have to work. They have to be part of the lay community. They have to go to work. They have to bring in money for the rest of the community. It's not really an option.
I think there still is an option.
No?
Yeah.
In some communities, that might be true, but every mother house has to take care of its own. This is more true for nuns than, for example, priests. But I'm wondering about the different hybrid forms of practice that is.
Okay, so you're asking specifically, like using the model of the Catholic nuns, saying that many of them have to go to work nowadays to support themselves. And so are there hybrid forms of practice that might be suitable in the West for Buddhist nuns? I think in the Christian communities, those communities as a whole made choices to live in certain ways, and then the individuals within them make choices to be in that community. So you choose to be in a community. You know, nobody's sitting there binding you to that. There's some Carmelite nuns that live near us, and they don't really work. They one day a week they go in and work at a Catholic hospital, taking care of elderly nuns, and they get paid some money from that. But aside from that, they don't do much. There might be some kind of online something they do once in a while, but they live a very, very contemplative, simple life. So it is possible, you know, people, different orders make different choices, and then individuals decide which orders they're going to join. In terms, if people want to live a hybrid life, then I recommend that they remain as lay people, and they take the five precepts, or even the eight precepts. Okay? I think if you're going to be a monastic, then you need to be a monastic. It doesn't make much sense to be a monastic and live like a layperson. That's my view. If you want to live like a layperson, be a layperson. Be a good layperson. Keep the eight precepts. Because most of if you look at the whole spectrum of precepts for the fully ordained, they boil down, you know, most of them boil down to one of the eight precepts. So if you really want to practice, you know, live with the eight precepts. You get a lot of good karma keeping the eight precepts. You're as a lay person. There's no problems with your not wearing robes and not shaving your head. But then somebody says, but I want to wear robes. I want to shave my head. Then if you want to do that and you want to be seen as a monastic, be a monastic. Because those people, then they put on robes, they shave their head, and then they say, but I have to go to work, so then I have to take off my robes and I have to grow my hair out. Then what's the purpose? What's the purpose? You know, really. If you're going to ordain so that you can put on lay clothes and grow your hair, I mean, personally speaking, I don't see the sense. Okay? I think if you're going to be a monastic, be a monastic. Now the question comes up, people don't support Western monastics, right? Is that your question?
Yeah?
People don't support Western monastics. Okay. So, first of all, that's why we need communities. I mean, that's why I'm starting Srivasti Abbey, so that people have a place where they can come as an ordained person and get room and board and do their practice. Then people say, oh, but then I don't have a lot of other money. What else do you need money for as a monastic? Okay, you might need some money for health insurance. Might need some money to get your teeth fixed. Okay, we don't need a lot of money. If your mind is saying, well, I need a certain kind of bed, and I need certain kind of food, and I want my bookshelf to be this way, and I want to have my own books, not use the library books, and I want my own up-to-date computer that is only my computer with all the latest gadgets, and I need a Palm Pilot, and I need a this, and I need a that, and I need my own car. I would say if you feel like you need all those things for your own personal use, better to be a good lay practitioner. Yeah? If you live in a community, why do you need your own car? Why? And isn't part of our practice, you know, if you read, go back and read the sutras, you know, you are going from householder life into homeless life. This is what the Buddha talked about monastic ordination, is that dividing line. You are leaving home life, going into homeless life. Okay? So if you want to have all those things from a home life, in my opinion, have them. But then be a good lay practitioner. And keep precepts. And you can keep your lay precepts very well. You can practice very well. Okay? But, you know, we become monastics because we are choosing to live a simple lifestyle. You know? And there has to be that choice. That's how the Buddha set up the Sangha. He didn't set up the Sangha as a wealthy institution where everybody gets what they want. You know, the initial Sangha, they were mendicants. I mean, we have so much more compared to the initial Sangha. We have rooms to sleep in. We don't go out in the villages with our alms bowl. We know we're going to have food. Okay, we already have so much more than those people do. So what if the bookshelf isn't exactly the way I want it? You know? And with cars, I feel especially strongly monastics should not own cars. Because our car is a sign of our independence. When we have a car, I can go where I want, I can do what I want. Yeah? And that's what I found. We had one monastic come stay at the library, at the Abbey. You know, he had his own car. Then one day who knows what happened? He just drove off. You know? And that's the best way to escape from dealing with your mind when you have your own car. You just go somewhere else. Okay? When we're monastics, we're making a commitment to deal with our own mind. Yeah. If you want to be a monastic, what do you need to own a house for? Yeah, you're leaving the household life. If you really want to own a house, you know, come work at an abbey or a monastery and help the whole community. Why do we need our own houses as monastics? Okay. When I ordained, okay, I had a little bit of savings. I had maybe about $500 in savings at that time. And I made a determination when I got ordained that I was never going to go out and get a job. I just said, you know, I am not going out to get a job because the Buddha said, you know, that if you practice, you're not going to starve. He said, if you're practicing sincerely, you won't starve. And I said, okay, I have to jump and I have to trust what the Buddha said. Okay, in March, it will be my 30th anniversary. I haven't starved. And I've never gone out and got a job. Okay, it has been very difficult. I was here in India with $50. Okay, I was rationing my toilet paper because I didn't have enough money. When you come to the point of rationing your toilet paper, you know you're really poor. Okay? So, you know, I lived in France. In the cold winter, I did not have enough money to heat my room. Okay. So, I think sometimes going through a little bit of difficulty is very good for us. It makes us appreciate the Dharma. It makes us appreciate what we have. Yeah. And we find that, you know, we can maintain our ordination and we can, you know, make do without having everything we want. We really can. So nobody's asking us to starve. No. Nobody's asking us to sleep on nails. No. We lie down on a bed when we sleep. We eat food. We keep our body healthy and clean. Yeah. That's the four requisites that the Buddha set out. You know, shelter, clothing, food and medicine. You know, we have those. Then within that we practice. We don't need to have everything that everybody else in who's a layperson has. That's the kind of life they've chosen. We're choosing a different life. Okay.
It's not just that they could not be monastics if they wanted to stay with their teacher and mm-hmm. say, I totally agree with you, and I did the same mm-hmm. way myself for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I run an organization to support Tibetan or non-Tibetan monastics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are in a situation where they're living with their teacher who's charging them rent, and they want to be near their teacher, serve their teacher, get teachings from their teacher, and the only way they can do that is by paying rent. And by working. So it's really hard to have to.
Yeah, I know. And I really disagree with that. Mm. I really disagree with what's happening in the West with people being charged for Dharma teachings.
Yeah.
And I really disagree with people charging, you know, rent to monastics.
Mm.
Yeah, it puts them in such a difficult position. How are they supposed to keep their ordination and pay rent? How?
But it's like if they want to pursue the teachings. But also it's the same with parents, you know, like it's not like they can shove the baby back in and forget it happened, you know, like they do have a limited time, they do have a responsibility to their child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in that situation it's not always every choice is an option, like it's happened.
Okay.
They
so you're talking about
time.
People ordaining if they have children.
No, I'm just saying generally, not everybody's in a situation where they where every choice is open to them.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have to accept that. And if
mm-hmm.
every choice is not open to them, it's better to live a good life the way you do. If you have young children, I don't think you should ordain.
No, I'm
yeah?
not saying. I'm just saying separately.
Okay.
Separate issues. Just not everybody uh-huh. has every choice.
Right. Yeah. But in that situation, those people are choosing to be near their teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now maybe what they need to do is talk to their teacher and say, you know, I'm really trying, I became ordained because you were a good example. You don't work for a living. You live off donations. I want to be like you. I want to try and live off of donations. Okay. I mean, it's a place, some of the places I stayed at, you know, we had to pay too. And I just lived off of donations. So, I mean, this is why, you know, I'm setting up the alley, because I think this is the whole thing that's happening with Dharma in the West. I really disagree with, you know, people being charged for teachings. This is one of my soapboxes, so please endure me, you know. But if you look, I mean, the Buddha didn't charge anybody. Yeah, Dharma is free. It should be open to everybody. And as part of our practice, we should support the Dharma, okay? I'll use the example of Srivastava, yeah, because this is the way we do things. When people come there, it doesn't matter if you're a lay person or you're monastic, you do not pay for anything. We do not charge people, even to live there, okay? We also eat only the food that's been offered to us. We do not buy food, okay? So that means that when people come, yeah, what we're trying to encourage in them is, this is how we live. If you believe in how we live, you know, consider generosity as part of your practice and put your funds where your values are. Because if we charge you and you pay, then we don't get any merit from giving and you don't get any merit from giving, from paying. Or for giving, you know, because it's just a business deal. You come to Dharma Center, you pay business. Yeah? There's no merit for anybody in that kind of situation. If you give the Dharma freely, and then the people who receive it give freely to support you so that you can continue to give the Dharma freely, then everybody creates so much positive potential. Okay? It's called an economy of generosity. It's totally anti-Western capitalist. But so what does it fit in with our capitalist society? You know, I think it's a good way to try and live. Because then our lives become lives of generosity, and other people have the opportunity to support our lives and to be generous themselves. Then we're all giving to each other. What happens to all of our minds when we cultivate the motivation to give? You know, then all of our minds become happy. I'm giving to you because I want to give to you. You're giving to me because you want to give to me. We're all happy giving to each other. That's what Dharma practice is about. If we're doing business, we don't develop that mind of that takes delight in giving. We become very selfish. How can I get enough money for my monastery to build what I want to build in my monastery? You know? And then we're fundraising. How can I get other people to give me money? Okay. At the Abbey, we call it inviting generosity. Okay. We tell people what we want to do. We invite them to be generous. If they support us, we do it. If we don't have enough support, we don't build the building. Very simple. No? So this is really, it's very different than how things are done in the Tibetan tradition, but I'm trying to bring things back to be more in line with how the Buddha initially set it out for the monastic life. Yeah. And, you know, there's so much joy. I mean, because I don't charge for teachings, I can do prison work. I do a lot of work with inmates. Yeah. The last people who have the money to pay are inmates. Yeah, but because I live a life where I don't have to go and teach in dependence upon who's going to give me, you know, the most dana, or who I can charge the most to, you know, I'll go teach you if you charge $50 for a talk or for this or that, and I'll go teach. I don't do that. I'm free. I can teach whoever I want to, whoever feels good to me to teach because they seem like they're really ripe and sincere. I have the freedom to do that. Then the people who see value in what I do, then they support. Okay? So that means I can go work with the inmates. Okay.
Yeah. I brought up something similar like this a training organization has, and they said one of the reasons they couldn't give away Dharma teaching is because initially in the beginning, when Dharma first came, but started Buddhism, That's because they started creating the karma of only having that business kind of like for paying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so now the teacher said we can't change that. You know, this is, you will always have a karma to be independent. I wonder if you had a response.
Wait,
you'd always be independent from this kind of transaction, like of charging fees for dharma.
Okay.
That says that we can't ever change that.
We can't ever change
because
that.
Because the karma was created.
I don't believe it. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Sounds like an excuse to keep charging.
I mean, when you have your response, you know,
yeah.
Well, what our teachers say, you know, what the lamas say.
That's what the lamas say, yeah. But we're there to learn the dharma from the lamas. We're not there to learn how to charge people for teachings from the lamas. Okay, what they do is their business, but how we set up our communities, how we live our lives, is our thing. That's the way I feel. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to judge somebody else. If they feel like they need to do that, okay, but that doesn't mean I have to.
Well, so you said that what prices can residents do when you introduce them to Buddhism and new things,
yeah.
And they are sincere and they say yes, what can we do? How can we practice?
How can we practice? Okay, so what's like the basic Buddhist practice for Westerners to do in our lives? I think Lamrim and Lojung are the basic things. Yeah, to learn, you know, first of all, I think we need to study so that we have the Buddhist worldview, so that we understand, you know, what is the mind? What is samsara? What is nirvana? What is the path to enlightenment? What is karma? How does it operate? You know, I think we need to learn those things, and we need to contemplate them so that our whole worldview shifts, and we actually live as if we're believing in those things. Okay, so we do a lot of the Lamrim meditation. I think it's extremely helpful. And then the thought training practices. No? You familiar with those? Like in the 7-point thought training, or thought training like Rays of the Sun, the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, the 8 verses of thought transformation. It's a whole genre of teachings that teach us how to work with our mind. You know, and specifically how to transform adversity into the path to enlightenment. Okay? And transforming adversity into the path of enlightenment, that's the real key to being able to continue to practice. Because if we can't do that, then the moment we face adversity, we fall apart. Okay? So those kinds of teachings, I think, are very practical in terms of helping us to look at our mind and deal with the very gross levels of attachment and anger and jealousy and selfishness. And they're very helpful for shifting our mind into a worldview that takes into consideration karma and rebirth. Okay? Because when we really begin to think that there's going to be future lives, then we become concerned with what causes are we creating for what we're going to experience in the future. And so we become interested in karma. That leads us to understand ethical conduct, you know, how important it is to let go of the 10 negative actions and create the 10 positive ones. And, you know, when we understand the importance of doing that, then we put a lot of attention and intention in our practice on living an ethical life. You know, when we live an ethical life, then our mind becomes so much calmer because it isn't full of so much guilt and regret and remorse and conflicted emotions and doubt about our decisions. You know, so our mind's much more peaceful. So I think for Westerners beginning the practice, you know, these are really good, solid, practical things to do. I do not advise that people take tantric initiations at the beginning. I think it's much more important that we understand our mind as it is now and how to improve it, rather than take a lot of empowerments and we're visualizing ourselves as other things when we don't even know who we are now. Okay? So you know, if people want to do practices like Chenrezig or Manjushri or Tara that are the lowest class, the lower classes of Tantra, you know, that can be okay after a few years of practice where you understand, you know, why to do those things. But to really wait on highest class of Tantra and even those, the lower classes of Tantra, not jump into them right away. That makes some sense? Okay. And then, you know, when you're a layperson in the West, then to really set your priorities in a way that's comfortable to you. You know, now, and so this whole thing of saying I choose to rather than I have to. So somebody's going to say, well, okay, well, should I choose to meditate for 4 hours a day? Yeah. Well, maybe we're not capable of meditating for 4 hours a day. Okay. We shouldn't choose to do things that we're not capable of doing yet. Okay. So when you're a beginner, or if you're living a very busy life, then choose to do a period of meditation that feels comfortable for what you're capable of doing now. You know, if your back hurts and your knees hurt and you're really restless after a half an hour, then only meditate for a half an hour. That's good. If you do it daily on a daily basis to meditate for a half an hour, that's fantastic. It's going to be putting a half an hour of really good stuff in your mind. Okay? And then in the evening, maybe, you know, sit and read a Dharma book for another half an hour. That's great. If you can't read for an hour, read for half an hour. If you can read for 45 minutes, do that. If you can read for an hour, do that. You know? And when you read a Dharma book, don't sit and, you know, read it really fast so you can read the next one really fast. But read a Dharma book and read it really slow and think about what you're reading. You know, really think about it and apply it to your life. You know, and then it will have a really strong impact on you. And then slowly as you understand the Dharma better and better, yeah, then you can start doing more of the philosophical teachings, taking initiations or whatever. But I think our basic solid practice has to be, you know, one that's based on good ethical conduct and one that's based on living, you know, cultivating bodhicitta. Okay. And of course, cultivating bodhicitta means cultivating renunciation. And renunciation doesn't mean renouncing happiness. Renunciation means renouncing suffering and the causes of suffering. I think it's very important to remember. Otherwise people think, oh, renunciation, I have to go live in a cave. Now we're renouncing suffering and the causes of suffering. Okay? But, you know, we have to practice according to the level that we're at and be okay doing with what we're doing. And, you know, there may be people who are capable of doing better than or more than we're doing. That's wonderful. Rejoice. Don't squeeze yourself to try and do more than you're capable of doing. It's better to be able to do what you're doing and do it well and have a sense of fulfillment, like the Dharma is really nourishing you. And if you do that, then you'll be able to add a little bit more on, you know, slowly, slowly, as time goes on. But if we get it in our mind that, you know, I'm going to be Milarepa right away, you know, forget it. Should we sit quietly for a little bit and call this digestion meditation? Okay. In this meditation, well, just for a few minutes, but think about some of the things that you heard and try and put them into practice in your life. And if your mind is fighting against something that you heard, ask yourself, what in me is fighting this? You know, what's happening here? And then let's dedicate. And so let's rejoice that we were able to spend the morning contemplating the Dharma and rejoice at our own merit or positive potential as well as that created by everybody else here, and really feel the power of the group karma, positive karma we've created as a group, and then let's send that out into the universe together with our heartfelt aspirations that all living beings may be free of illness and injury, that their minds may be peaceful and joyful, that they think, that all of us think, only of benefiting each other. And so let's dedicate so that we can all develop a heart of loving kindness for each other, for all living beings. And then realize the ultimate nature of reality for the ultimate aim of becoming Buddhas, so that we can offer service in the most effective way to each and every living being. So again, many congratulations about what you're doing in your community here and what you've set up. And especially Annie Zongma, she's put an incredible energy and dedication to create this community. I'm sure it has not been easy for her. And so as much as all of you can gather together and support each other in, you know, with her vision, and go forward and really do something wonderful that benefits you in your own practice, the broader community now, and then future generations of practitioners. Very good. Thank you.